Good morning, everyone. We return to our study of Jesus as a teacher and things that he taught. And it's almost like a twofold study. We're having these mini lessons about what he taught, but also keeping an eye on how he approaches trying to teach and lead and instruct and guide people. So thank you for your participation in that. And it would probably be good for me to pull my class outline out rather than my sermon outline. Pulled the wrong outline out. You don't want to hear the same thing twice. So
there we go. Now we're set.
Ray, can you lead us in prayer?
Yeah. Heavenly Father, thank you that we can be here today and this morning. Thank you for Philip, the work he's done to prepare. And help us as students to gain from this time. And Philip is a teacher. And the other teachers teaching here, that your will is done and that you're glorified by our presence here. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. So this question was, and I think it's a common question that people have about teachers. Was Jesus a hard teacher or an easy teacher? Right? Remember, at one time in your life, you probably said, oh, I've got so-and-so. She's a hard teacher. Or you thought, I've got so-and-so. He's easy. You know, that kind of thing. Think about that question. Was he an easy teacher or a hard teacher?
I'd say both.
Okay. All right. Okay, let's talk about this. Let's see if there's merit to this. In what ways would Jesus be an easy teacher?
I think like in the situation like with Zacchaeus. You know, he was wanting to see Jesus, and so he climbs up in a tree, you know. But then and we see that he gives away half of his to the poor and this and that. And then you look at the rich young ruler. It was real hard for him to give up those earthly things. So for Zacchaeus, it was easy. Yeah. For the rich young ruler, it was hard.
Yeah, it's a contrast. Yeah. So what are some things that might have made Jesus an easy teacher?
Easy to understand.
Okay. What did he do that made his teaching easy to understand?
Practical teaching.
It's very practical. Very everyday behaviors. Situations.
Parables that people could understand.
The parables and the analogies, the illustrations were about things everybody understood. He didn't talk about nuclear physics. He talked about farming, cleaning a house, trading goods, a ruler ruling a kingdom, things that they were familiar with. Right. What else made his teaching easy?
Yeah. The relationship he had with people close to him.
Yeah. If a teacher cares and is interested in you, it engages you. They're more approachable. Was Jesus an approachable teacher? You could ask him questions. You could go to him. Yeah. He never said, I don't have time for you. We've looked at an example where the disciples were trying to keep the children away from Jesus. And Jesus said, no, let them come. All right. In what way was Jesus a hard teacher? So we're going with Dave's answer, okay? We're committed to Dave's answer. Was he a hard teacher and in what ways? Yeah, Les.
Well, I would say that we have an advantage today of having poured over his teaching over and over and over again. And so, if many of us have grown up hearing these teachings, but if you heard it one time on the spot, a lot of it would be very hard.
Yeah.
Because he's comparing known things with unknown things oftentimes. And so, that makes it hard, but I think it goes back partly to the parable of the sower. So it depends on, what your heart is like. Because the Pharisees, well, even though they did understand when he was talking about them, it seemed like their hearts were not for him, and so therefore they wrestled with his words, whereas the people who were more of the common people seemed to understand and follow him because they knew that he was talking too about the humility of, you know, the whole sermon, you know, beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, the Beatitudes, as we call them, you know, that they could grasp hold of that and understand that he was talking language that they could identify with, because they were not the elite as they saw themselves. Mm-hmm. And Jesus was speaking to them in their own, with their own character.
Right. So. Yeah, what an advantage we have that we know the teachings of Jesus through writings. You can read something and go back, now what was that again? And go back and read it again, as opposed to hearing it in person live. And there are a lot of big concepts that he talks about. He does use common illustrations, but the concepts about the kingdom and eternity and even the concept of the Father in heaven is a challenging one. Do you ever encounter in your readings about Jesus' teachings where people are left scratching their head and people are like, what's going on? I don't know if I get this. You see that sometimes, right? That's not because Jesus was inadequate in his communication. That impact, that reaction was on purpose. He wanted to leave them scratching their heads. And it goes back to that parable of the soils, that are you going to work through this filter of the parable and try to figure out what he's saying? Or are you going to be just like, I don't want to invest the time and the energy to understand this and just walk away because it's not important? So I think Dave's exactly right that there are things about Jesus' teaching that it's just so simple and straightforward and easy to understand. And he is definitely the kind of teacher that you were drawn to, which makes it easier to understand. I remember having an algebra teacher in high school that I was scared to death of her. If she walked in the door right now, I'd probably hide. I was scared to death of her. I don't think she's living now, so I'm good. But so I didn't do well in that class. And that was part of the reason, is that relationship she had. And Jesus, people just flocked to Jesus. And a lot of it had to do with he spoke like no man spoke. He was a completely unique teacher, but also there was this compassion and this love about him that drew people to him, just like the woman in Luke 7. And we did this in a sermon recently, who's the sinful woman, but she's drawn to come and wash his feet. And so he did not repulse people. He drew people. And so there are all these reasons why, but yet at the same time, he taught challenging things. And even if it was challenging to have the right concept about it, it was all that many times challenging to obey. It was very challenging to obey. And so that separated people. Okay, well, let's look at another approach to Jesus' teaching, and that is the use of leading questions. I've sort of held back on this because it's worth focusing a couple of classes on, and that is Jesus' use of questions. There's nothing more important in teaching than questions. Do you agree? Okay, that's on purpose. We'll get to that here. So when it comes to Jesus questioning, there are different ways you could categorize them. And the ones we want to focus on today have to do with leading questions. So go with me. We hope to look at four texts here, and two of them are similar. In Luke chapter 5, we're trying to keep it in Luke because these readings are fresh on our minds, because we're reading currently in Luke as a congregation. And Luke chapter 5, verses 33-39. Luke 5, 33-39. Gary, could you read those for us?
And they said to him, the disciples of John fast often and often pray, and so do the disciples of Pharisees, for years eat and drink. Jesus said to them, can you make wedding guests fast while the bridegroom is with them? The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast in those days. He also told them a parable. No one tears a piece from a new garment and puts it on an old garment. If he does, he will tear the new, and the piece from the new will not match the old. And no one puts new wine into old wineskins. If he does, the new wine will burst the skins and it will be spoiled. and the skins would be destroyed. But new wine must be put into fresh wine skins, and no one after drinking old wine desires new, for he says, the old is good.
All right, thank you. So Jesus has a question here early in this text, and that question is a reaction. To what is it a reaction?
About fasting and prayer.
They want to know that the disciples of John the Baptist had a lot of people who were listening to his teaching and would be considered his disciples, his learners, and they were taught to fast, okay, and offer prayers. We've recently talked about fasting in another context, and they want to know why you don't teach your disciples to fast. So Jesus answers, they don't really ask him a question, they just make a statement. John taught this, you teach this, your disciples do this. So it's a statement they make. Sometimes Jesus asks a question in response to a question, but this is in response really to a statement. So this question that Jesus asks back, what's his point about fasting and feasting?
There's a certain time for that.
There's a time for it. Fasting, there's a time for feasting, and now's the time for feasting. Okay. And in that answer, how does he present himself? It's an analogy. The bridegroom. So wedding ceremonies, wedding traditions, I think it's this Wednesday night we're going to talk about family and marriage a little bit in the New Testament world class on Wednesdays. I don't know if I'll get into this or not, but weddings were different. And what happened was that the bride would typically be at her mom's and dad's house, and it would be the bridegroom. The groom would be in a procession, as opposed to our typical thing where everybody gathers in a room and the bride walks in and all attention's on her. It was the opposite. So the bridegroom would come in with a procession, family, friends, etc., and they would come in together. And so it's the idea that once the bridegroom gets there, it's a time for celebration. That's the point, which involves eating and drinking. So he says, the bridegroom is with you. Who's the bridegroom? Jesus. He is. I'm here, so it's a time to enjoy my company. And how do we enjoy one another's company? We sit down and have a meal together. So he would go in these people's houses, like Simon, and like Matthew's house, and like Zacchaeus' house, and he would go and sit down and have these meals with these people and commune with them, so to speak, and talk and interact with them, because he was there. But what is he, in using this analogy about the bridegroom, what is he teaching? That there will come a time when what? He's not going to be there. He's going to leave. And so that's when, you know, do you keep celebrating the wedding once the bride and groom leaves? Maybe you've been to a wedding like that. You know, maybe like, I'm glad they're gone and let's have a good time. I don't know. But usually that when the bride and groom leave, everybody departs and they go home. The feasting is over. And that's what he's saying. There's coming a time when the feasting will be over because the company of the bridegroom you will not be enjoying. And this goes to latter New Testament illustrations that Christ is the husband, and who's his bride?
Church.
The church. Yeah. Dave, do you have your hand?
Well, it seems to me that even though the question was asked about material food and all, that Jesus gave the spiritual answer about feasting on himself while he was present.
Yeah.
And then there would be sorrow and fasting when he was gone.
Yeah. Yeah. He does talk to the disciples in John about how they're going to be sorry when he leaves. There's going to be a sorrow when he leaves. But then later they'll know a joy. And of course, he's talking about the resurrection and things like that. So, yeah, that kind of idea pops up in a couple of places in the Gospels. And then he follows this question. The question being, can you make wedding guests fast while the bridegroom is with them? He follows that question to them with a couple of parables. Now, most parables are a story within themselves. We talked about that, but there are exceptions. Parables are like a rubber band. It's somewhat of a flexible kind of thing. And the text calls them parables, and it's more like we would call an analogy, but it is a parable in the text. These two parables illustrate what? that follow. The parables are about what? Common things.
Old and new.
Old and new. Old and new what? The wine and wineskins and garments. Okay? So what is his point in these parables? He's extending what he's saying about being the bridegroom and being among them. He's extending this and he's going into a little bit different domain. What's he illustrating?
He's saying, like all of us, we're resistant to change.
Okay.
We like what we know better. And when Jesus comes along and does something different, they don't like that.
Right. So what's behind this statement? The disciples of John fast and your disciples don't fast. Just like sometimes, and it's usually the scribes and Pharisees who have this issue with him. They want to know on another occasion why they ask him, why do your disciples not wash before they have meals? Had nothing to do with sanitation. Had everything to do with ritual purity that they thought you had to wash your hands or you became spiritually contaminated. And so they keep seeing Jesus do and say things and it doesn't line up. And so really the Pharisees and some others in these two analogies, they're like what? Old garment and the old wineskin. So the wineskins, we mentioned this recently, when they would take the juice from the grape, they would drink it at various stages. It was not just new and then completely fermented. There would be stages to it. And again, they cut it with water. It was a lot. Pretty much every alcoholic beverage today is loaded with a lot more alcohol than those in ancient times. That includes beer. Beer's been around since the Egyptians, okay? But they're much more potent now for a lot of reasons. Wines too. And so they would drink that wine at different stages. But if you took new wine that would tend to ferment in time, and as it ferments, it gives off gases. And so if you put that in an old wineskin that already had been stretched, it would stretch it too far and it would burst and spill out. You had to put new wine in a new wineskin, fresh leather, so that it would give and expand. We're familiar with garments that either shrink or expand with age. Okay? And then after that, they really can't much after that. It's the same idea. And so what Jesus is saying is that there's some who can receive the new and some who can't. Just like a garment, if you sew a new piece to an old piece, it's not going to work. There's going to be a tear. So what Jesus is saying here is that I am saying and doing things. I am bringing things that not everyone is going to receive. And in many cases, it's the scribes and Pharisees he's having that conflict with. So what does this question do in this setting? You look at this whole text here. What does the question accomplish? It leads to explanations, doesn't it? They don't get this about Jesus. Why are you feasting with your disciples? They don't get that. And Jesus makes a bigger point. Yeah, you're not getting a lot of things. You're not getting this new garment and this new wine. You're not getting it. So he uses the question to address their comment, but then he launches from that into more that they need to understand. Are they going to be open and receptive to the new or resistant of the new? What else do you see the question accomplishing and doing?
I think it forces them to have to reason for themselves.
Okay. Have you noticed, like already in today's class, I've asked a couple of questions and things were real quiet. That's the best time. Okay? Because if I ask a question, then I stop and I wait. All of you are thinking. I hope so. That's what I'm counting on. You're thinking. Whether you're going to say something or not, you're thinking. If I say something and as soon as I say it, then I say something else or try to ask something else, you don't have time to process it, okay? And even it's even good when there's a delay in somebody saying something, because then everybody's thinking. It's a stimulant to the mental processes. Even a question that is hard to answer, can be a stimulant. It's like you don't want something so hard that it discourages someone, but you want it hard enough where they have to work for it. So just like Rachel said, it's stimulating them to think, okay, you want to, they're like, they don't really ask, but they're implying a question. John's disciples fasted. Your disciples are not fasting. Implied there is, what's up with that? And what Jesus says back to them, well, think about this. Do you fast when the bridegroom's still with you? And they're like, well, no. So what are you saying? Are you the bridegroom? In what way are you the bridegroom? I mean, the brain can operate that fast. It's much better than a computer. What are you saying? You're the bridegroom? What do you mean you're the bridegroom? You don't even have a wife. You're not betrothed to anybody. What do you mean? Oh, you must be something. Be saying something about this kingdom you're talking about. You must be talking about how that somehow about blessings from God, you're the bridegroom. I mean, they're putting all this together, hearing from him. Jesus, watch how many times Jesus asks questions. It's all the time. And I want you to think about this. Don't answer it. Why? Why does the Son of God, who has all the answers, why does he ask so many questions? All right, just stew on that. Go to the next text, Luke 6. And we got a couple that are similar here, but by the setting, they are very different situations, different people involved, etc. Luke chapter 6, verse 6 through 11. Hilton, can you read those verses? Luke 6, 6 through 11.
Happened on another Sabbath also that he entered the synagogue and taught, and a man was there whose right hand was withered. So the scribes and the Pharisees watched him closely whether he would heal on the Sabbath, that they might find an accusation against him. But he knew their thoughts and said to the man who had withered hand, "Arise and stand here." And he rose and stood. Then Jesus said to him, "I will ask you one thing. Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do evil, to save lives or to destroy?" And when he had looked around at them all, he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." And he did so, and his hand was restored as whole as the other. But they were filled with rage and disgusted with one another what they might do to Jesus.
All right, thank you. Remember, we've talked recently about the scribes and Pharisees on Wednesday nights and what the scribes and Pharisees had done over a long period of time. Is that they'd taken the written law of Moses and they encircled it with a wider barrier of their own traditions. So we don't violate the Sabbath. Let's make this rule. You can only carry so many sticks on the Sabbath. They had laws about that. How many sticks you could carry on the Sabbath to build a fire to make your bread. How far you could walk on a Sabbath down to a distant length. They had regulations about that. When does the law of Moses ever talk about how many steps you can take and how many sticks you can pick up? Okay, they didn't. But they had all these oral traditions that was passed on from generation to generation and had been changed along the way that encircled it. And you'll see this over and over and over. They had a hypersensitivity to laws about the Sabbath. They were extremely sensitive, probably as far as the gospel text goes. If you ranked what they were most worked up about is behavior on the Sabbath, then after that, ritual cleansings. Or something about ritual purity, about being around that person or going through this washing to make sure you're pure and make sure you don't touch this and so forth and what kind of food you eat and all that. And there's some of that in the law of Moses, but they went way beyond the law of Moses. So this is one of those Sabbath controversy situations. And Jesus' question back to them in verse 9 is, I ask you. Now, they hadn't asked a question. This is just a setting that's described. They're all there watching what he's going to do with this woman who needs to, this man that needs to be healed here. And they're all watching. And Jesus puts this man in the middle there, come and stand here with him in a prominent place. I ask you, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm? To save life or to destroy? Now, what does that question do? Do what?
creates a dilemma for them.
It's a dilemma for them. Because who wouldn't value saving a life? Who wouldn't value doing harm? I mean, doing good. Who would value doing harm? Who would value destroying a life? He puts it in very simple terms, so simple that he puts them on the spot. He hems them in a corner, doesn't he? He does that a lot. Yes.
He knew there was going to be an accusation and he beats them to it.
It is preemptive. They're waiting to criticize him. He preempts it. He puts the spotlight on them, doesn't he? He puts them on the hot seat. They're trying to put him on the hot seat. He puts them on the hot seat. Why do you think Jesus is that aggressive in this situation? Is he typically that aggressive on putting somebody in the spot? Not typically, not a lot. He does it some. With whom does he act this aggressive, this preemptive in his action? He puts them on the hot spot. Who does he do this with? Typically scribes and Pharisees or anybody. A couple times it's the Sadducees later on, but it's consistently scribes and Pharisees. It's people who what?
Have evil motives.
Their motives. They have an agenda of trying to catch him, destroy him, belittle him, make him look bad. They don't have a pure motive. They're not like the woman who came and washed his feet. They're not like Nicodemus. They're not like, you know, Zacchaeus. They're not those kinds of people. They're not coming open to learn. They're coming with a bad agenda. And so that's why he's preemptive, like Dave said. He heads this thing off at the pass. And they're forced to see what? He's trying to get them to see what with this question?
Bigger picture.
The bigger picture, rather than their tiny little oral traditions. Exactly. And how that their thinking is what?
Hypocritical.
Hypocritical, faulty, inconsistent, all those kinds of things. And, I mean, look at verse 7. They watched him to see that he would heal them, heal on the Sabbath, that they might find a reason to accuse him. That's the reason why Jesus acts this aggressively, why he puts them on the spot. Now, how successful was Jesus, it appears, with changing the minds of the scribes and Pharisees? Overall, Rachel, you're shaking your head. What? Not very?
Not very.
Not very. Because it's the scribes. Go ahead, Ray.
He was successful at getting to accomplish God's will more quickly.
Okay. They fall into place in doing their part in the providential plan unfolding. And in the end, it's the scribes and Pharisees who partner with the chief priests and the Sadducees. Remember recently on Wednesday nights, they're mortal enemies. Chief priests and Sadducees versus scribes and Pharisees. They join up to do him in. But there are some Pharisees that are saved, it appears. Nicodemus would be one, and so forth. And even some priests, whether they're in the upper class or the lower class, we see them talked about in the book of Acts, converting to Christ. But for the most part, he's not going to do that. But where did this take place? Verse 6.
In the synagogue.
So this was a public gathering. This question could have been just as much for the non-scribes and Pharisees in this audience as it was for them. And here's why it's viable to say that. Over and over through the Gospels, the evidence is that Jesus is saying things about the scribes and Pharisees, and sometimes even to the scribes and Pharisees, to expose them so that the bulk of the people would see their hypocrisy. As we noted the other day in the Wednesday night, the scribes and Pharisees, the Pharisees was the largest of the sects, but not everybody was a Pharisee, but the common people held them in high regard. They saw them as a standard of holiness. So Jesus has to reduce their influence. And you're talking about, here's this man with a withered hand. And Jesus says, is it good? What should you do on the Sabbath? Harm or good? What should you do? Destroy life or save it? And he heals this man. the average non-Pharisee who may have held them in high regard, boy, how could you criticize what Jesus is saying and doing here? You look completely foolish. You look ungodly. And so it really casts the Pharisees in a different light. And it's all started with this question. It's just this one question. And it's a bomb. But it goes back to Riccone's point. He's getting them to see the big picture. And that is, righteousness is not, godliness is not about nitpicking about what you do on the Sabbath day. You're to remember the Sabbath and keep it holy. It's not to be like any other day. But that doesn't prevent you from doing good. On another occasion, he says you circumcise on the Sabbath day. Jewish tradition was to circumcise on the eighth day. And he says you circumcise on the Sabbath day. And they should. And so he's trying to show their faulty thinking here. Okay, any other observations on this? Yeah, Les.
It's kind of interesting that throughout so much of what Jesus taught, he was including these verses that we just went over regarding the new that they should have known, really, because of Jeremiah 31 and many other passages, where God is saying, I'm going to make a new covenant with you, not according to the one that I made with Moses. It's going to be a new covenant where my law is going to be in your heart and all of those things. And so Jesus is really, throughout his teaching, he is making a polarizing contrast between the old and the new, and presenting himself as the new, the instigator, the initiator of the new covenant. And you see it here with the old garment, the new, and the wineskins, and that he's putting the new covenant into these younger apostles too, whereas the old guard, tends to be the Jewish leadership, and they are stuck in their ways, and you can't teach an old dog new tricks and all of that. And Jesus is coming in and presenting himself as the initiator of the new covenant because he is the Messiah.
Yeah, and I think that there would be a real dramatic experience that Paul would have once he converted that happens on a smaller scale with so many other people. Like, there were a lot of things the apostles didn't get, and then finally when he resurrected, it all fell in place. Oh, this is what was meant back in the Hebrew Scriptures. Oh, and there are many things they didn't understand, or they forgot, or they just didn't connect it to Jesus. Can you imagine with Paul's understanding that we see all in books like Romans and Galatians and Ephesians, his understanding of the Old Testament, but yet he had opposed that Jesus was the Christ, how blind he had been. And now he sees the Old Testament scriptures in a completely different light, which is what Jesus is doing in Luke 24, both on the road to Emmaus and in the upper room with the other apostles. He's opening the scriptures, all that was written about him and the law and the prophets and the Psalms. So they're not seeing him connected to the Old Testament like they should, and it's a fight and a struggle, but some eventually do. But it takes a lot of work. Exactly.
That's just thinking of what you were saying about the setting where he was asking this question, put it in more current ideas. Like, when you're in a debate with somebody, you're not necessarily trying to convert the person you're
right.
debating. You're questioning it so that the audience will make the decision. And
right. I think you see that setting in a lot of places in the Gospels. It was the debaters are trying to persuade the people. Yeah. So, and Adam, you raised your hand. I'm going to call on you next time you do that. Raising that hand up there got my attention. So, look at a case like this one, different but like it. Luke 13. And look how that this is similar, but it's different. Ken, can you read those verses for us? Luke 13, 10 to 17.
Now when he was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath, and behold, there was a woman who had a disabling spirit for 18 years. She was bent over and could not fully straighten herself. When Jesus saw her, he called her over and said to her, "Woman, you are freed from your disability. And he laid his hands on her, and immediately she was made upright, made straight, and she glorified God. But the ruler of the synagogue, indignant because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath, said to the people, "There are 6 days in which work ought to be done. Come on those days and be healed, and not on the Sabbath day." Then the Lord answered him, "You hypocrites, does not each one of you on the Sabbath untie his ox or his donkey from the manger and lead it away to water it? And ought not this woman, a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan bound for 18 years, be loosed from this bond on the Sabbath day?" And he said these things, and as he said these things, all his adversaries were put to shame, and all the people rejoiced at all the glorious things that were done by him.
Okay, let's do the what's alike and what's different here. What's alike about this setting, the situation in relation to the one we just read in Luke 6 about the man with the withered hand? In the synagogue, on the Sabbath, a healing. Different. It's a man, first time, now it's a woman. He had a withered hand. She has some kind of disability that causes her to be bent over. Okay, you know, we see conditions like that. What else is alike? Okay, extreme, chronic, you know, painful kind of condition that you feel your heart goes out to the person, okay, suffering. And you got two groups of people there, right? Just like back in Luke 6. You got some that are looking at Jesus and what? Very critical. You got others that see this thing and read it openly and they respond to it here. We'll talk about that in a second. How is this different? I mean, man, woman, different disease and all that. What else is different in this situation? If you're looking at Luke 6 and Luke 13 and you've got a dial, you know, an analog dial, not a digital dial, but an analog dial. And that dial is about intensity of the moment. Which would have a higher reading? The first one we read or this one? Why, Ray?
18 years, bent over double, they all okay. Were.
There's details about her severity. There you go. That's intense. What else is more intense in this situation?
The Pharisees actually teach here.
That's right. They actually are bold enough to say, "You ought to be healed on another day." How dare you come on the Sabbath to be healed? Okay, let's just stop right here. Time out. It's a healing. It's from God. It's a divine act. It's a miracle. It's not a run-of-the-mill thing. This is not about going out and plowing a field on the Sabbath. That's not what the Sabbath's about. Sabbath says, reflect on the Lord. Don't go out and plow the field on the seventh day. This is not that at all. So they're more aggressive here, aren't they? The critics are more aggressive here. What about Jesus? Do you think he turns it up? In what way?
You hypocrites.
He calls them hypocrites. There you go. He exposes hypocrisy in Luke 6. He exposes it and makes sure everybody gets it. Oh, everybody, these people are hypocrites. Underlines it, exclamation point. And then highlights it. Because then he doesn't say the general thing like, is it right to do good on the Sabbath or harm? He uses a more specific question here. His question is what? Who among you what?
Did not untie his donkey or whatever and lead him
to water.
Water.
You're already doing things on the Sabbath. He doesn't use the generic idea of harm or good. He says, you take care of your donkey on the Sabbath. He gets it real specific. You do this thing that is mundane on the Sabbath, and you don't have a problem with that, but you got a problem with this woman being healed who's been afflicted all these years? So he gets real specific in his questioning and his analogy here. He gives a picture of the ridiculous inconsistency of the people. that are criticizing him. And what do you see in verse 17 as far as intensity?
Adversaries were put to shame here.
It says two things. The adversaries were put to shame, and the people what?
Rejoiced.
You don't see that, you know, in that first one. Now, in that first one, you saw how that the adversaries were angry and began to think, what are we going to do with him? Here it says that they're put to shame. What Jesus does here is so plain to everybody in this setting that everybody sees the eggs on their face. It's not a deal where you got two groups tugging and one group walks out the door and says, yeah, Jesus was right. And the other group walks out and says, no, Jesus was wrong. This is the situation where it is clear that Jesus' critics here look bad. Now, understand why these people got so angry at him? They wanted to kill him? This kind of thing kept building, you see. Because this is up in Galilee, not in Jerusalem. Yeah.
There in 16, Jesus says that Satan has been having his way. Mm. So he's like saying, well, let's give God the glory on the Lord's day for something good.
Right. Well, on the Sabbath day, we're trying to free her from Satan. And the implication is you're trying to block a rescue of this woman from Satan, which puts them on whose side? And this is all prompted by a question. Does not each of you on the Sabbath untie his ox and donkey from the manger and lead him to water? And you find a fault with this woman being healed who suffered so long. I mean, it's just glaringly inconsistent. And you see it ratcheted up several notches here from Luke 6. It's a different day, a different setting, different people, but word gets around. When you read the Gospels, it is clear that without cell phones and internet, word got around about what Jesus was doing and saying. And these things circulated. And this is intensifying. So, okay. Any other observations about Luke 13 or questions about what he's doing there? And all right, let me ask this. Instead of going to the next text, let me ask a couple general questions. So why does the Son of God, God the Son, why does he come asking questions? He's got all the answers. Why does he ask questions?
People to think.
It's not for his information, is it? It's get them to think. What else? It's a critical, constant method of his teaching. So we're not doing this a lot, but for those of you who teach, you need to plan questions. Not just things that pop in your head, but you need to purposely plan your questions. Because that's where students really learn, is through questions. So what else comes to mind? Besides, okay, getting the people to think through questions, why else does the Son of God, living as the Son of Man, ask questions? What else do you see in these episodes? That
separating wheat from chaff and exposing it.
In this act of getting people to think, it has a filtering effect, doesn't it? Well, you see that in the last two, don't you? In Luke 6 and Luke 13. You see the filtering effect of these questions. In this one, very dramatically in Luke 13, verse 17, you got some sitting there shamefaced, embarrassed, and others glorifying God and rejoicing because this woman's been healed. And, you know, synagogues were community synagogues. So that means the people there knew that woman. They knew her. This is like a local congregation. It's a congregation of Hebrews or Jews and in a community. And so they knew one another. And so they rejoiced to see this woman delivered like this. And this question sets it all up and is filtering these people. Yes?
I wonder if part of the reason for his "you hypocrites" was because the ruler of the synagogue assumed that this woman had come to be healed.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, see how Jesus' reputation has gotten around. You see it in Luke 6 too, that when they see a sick or a hurt person coming around Jesus, they're expecting something. And it shows what kind of reputation he has. Well, duh, what should that be telling those people regarding who Jesus is and how you should be listening to him if you're expecting him to do something like this? So it really is a filtering thing. Yeah. You know, just by their nature, what do questions do? We've talked about the idea of it gets you thinking. Let's go further with it. By nature, what do, right?
Who's in control of the situation? Who's in control of that discourse?
Now, Jesus is leading it. See that? He's leading it.
See, I used a question just then.
Can I answer? Jesus is leading them. He is instructing them with questions. And as that, he's leading, he's trying to get them to a point, from point A to point B. The question is like the pathway. It's like Hansel and Gretel dropping the breadcrumbs. This is the path. I'm going to ask these questions to get you to this point. That's what leading questions do. They get people to a place. Okay, we'll keep talking about questions next time. Thank you.